Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
You know, I'd really rather just burn all my books to ash and then throw them all over the house.
I just want to be covered in ashes.
I just want to roll in the ashes.
It's atmosphere.
It's so biblical, man. So fucking deep.
Very tastefully avoiding the blackface reference that popped into my head.
Oh my god. Cut, start again. Edit out Ben's racism. Hello, and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast.
A podcast about one sibling who is a racist.
And now I'm really suppressing some comments because I cannot put them on the internet in ink.
Okay, well, moving on. This week, we read The Road by Cormac McCarthy, winner of a Pulitzer Prize. For anyone who doesn't read a lot, I guess that's a stupid thing to say if you're listening to this podcast. For anyone who doesn't really know contemporary classic authors, I guess. Cormac McCarthy is the guy who wrote No Country for Old Men, which is that movie that won an Oscar several years ago that a lot of people liked.
Hooray.
They made Javier Bardem a big old creeper. And before we get started on The Road, we do have some statistics for you. I feel like we should make this a new category, like intern research.
Well, it's just a little follow-up here. So last week we were speculating on what the statistics were on unreported rape.
Yeah, because we read Speak, which
revolves around a character who was raped.
Yes. And so Alex Chern, our brand new intern, who said we were allowed to use his real name on the internet, looked up some statistics for us. So first we were saying how we thought a majority of sexual assaults were not reported, and that is true. It's not actually as bad as I thought, but it's still bad. So 54% of sexual assaults are not reported, which is over half, so that's not really okay. We were also discussing how the book is relevant because a lot of teenagers have to deal with sexual assaults, and the book rolls around a teenager.
Right.
And so 44% of rape victims are under the age of 18, which is nearly half.
Yep.
So
children, basically.
Yes.
There's a point in our favor, society.
80% are under the age of 30, which I thought was interesting, actually.
Yeah, though I think it kind of fits with my conception of what the crime is. Just because I always picture a younger person environment, like a more party-ish environment,
uh-huh.
Or people hanging out and just people making bad and criminal decisions.
Yeah, I should have had you look up what percentage of rapes are done by someone who knows the victim.
It's something like 34%,
okay.
Somewhere in there. I didn't write that one down, but I remember seeing it.
I know that one's pretty high as well.
I got that. I saw that in the same organization that I pulled these statistics from. So
okay.
It is pretty high.
Yeah. And I think especially for people in the under 18 age range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably true.
And then here's the most horrifying statistic of all. 97% of rapists don't go to jail. So that means out of every 100 rapes, only 3 of those people face jail time.
I was pretty shocked when I read that one, too.
And it's jail time. It's not even necessarily like they get put away for...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just any jail time at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, which is... another thing we were talking about, how a lot of rapists commit multiple...
Yeah, repeat offenders.
Right,
right.
Because
yeah.
They don't get in trouble for it.
Yeah. Right.
So.
And I imagine that's a difficult I imagine part of that is it's difficult to prove in court, but part of that reason it's difficult to prove in court is because as a society we're probably not as receptive to giving the victim the benefit of the doubt.
That's what I was going to say, like, I feel like a lot of cases probably go down to he said, she said kind of thing.
I'd be uncomfortable imprisoning someone for that too,
right,
to be fair.
But, and considering, you know, the amount that go unreported, or if you're embarrassed about it for a month until you finally say something, they can't do a rape kit on you.
Right.
So there are a lot of things working against the victims in that case, I think.
Unfortunate.
Yeah.
On a not at all lighter note, the road.
I'm actually going to say this is kind of a good opening to the road, because the road is incredibly bleak and horrifying, kind of like what we were just talking about. And Ben's laughing.
I can't help myself.
Uncomfortable laughter.
I can't help myself.
So, yeah, let's go ahead and move on and talk about the road.
Sure. So, the road is a post apocalyptic novel that we chose, well, partly because we needed some contemporary fiction in our rotation, but it's also one that happens to have won a Pulitzer Prize, or possibly a Pulitzer Prize.
And I guess depending on how you
want to
pronounce it.
Oh, right. I should have looked that up on the website. It's in there, Frequently Asked Questions.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
I believe it.
I didn't think it would come up. I just assumed we were pronouncing it correctly.
you know what they say about assumptions.
Yes, I do.
But I would go ahead and venture that the Pulitzer Prize is one of the few prizes awarded for pretty much anything that everybody has heard of.
That's what I was going to say. If someone says, this book won a Pulitzer, then you immediately go, oh.
Yeah, it's intriguing. It's like, oh, well, it must be a work of great art.
Yeah. And I think Doubt won a Pulitzer, right? In 2005.
Oh, did it?
I think so. I think that was the other one we read that was a Pulitzer Prize.
Well, it deserved it.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree. And here's the interesting thing about the Pulitzer Prize, which I never knew, which, again, we have to credit our intern for looking this up for us, because we never do research. that the Pulitzer, I don't know, now that you've explained it, it reminds me a lot of the Oscars, where, like, people kind of arbitrarily pick what they think is a work of high art, and then, like, the most elite of those people get to choose which one's the best.
Yeah, so it gets nominated by a select group of people, and then the even more select group of people that selected them get to decide if their opinions are valid, I guess.
Yeah. And the organization was started, some guy basically left it in his will. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where it seems...
Someone named Pulitzer, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Someone named John Pulitzer.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where... you know, it seems like, yeah, they should be judging it by a high standard, but it's basically just this thing that this guy set up on his own, so.
Yeah, that thing I think my favorite fact is that if you have written a book, you can just go and submit your book to the Pulitzer Prize Committee for consideration, which really amuses me.
That is kind of funny.
Because I kind of want to get on and submit my book now. Consider this!
I wonder, well... Depends what the fee is, but
yeah.
I imagine that most books are probably actually submitted by publicists and publishers.
Yeah, yeah. Probably not the actual author.
Right.
And I'm assuming it has to have some kind of a bestseller or widespread notice.
Probably doesn't hurt if you're an Oprah Book Club book, for example.
Was The Road in the Oprah Book Club?
It
doesn't
is
seem
in
like
fact,
Oprah's kind of book. Oh,
that really, really surprised me, too.
Yeah.
And apparently, I haven't watched it yet, but apparently the interview that Oprah had with Cormac McCarthy is really funny.
Hmm.
Because he's just like, I don't know what I was doing. Yeah, I guess it's deep.
I saw.
That's funny. That fits my theories on what I think literature usually is.
Yeah.
I saw a picture of Cormac McCarthy accepting the award on the actual website, because part of the submission requirement is you have to submit a picture of the author. It's like you submit the book and also a picture of the author. And the picture of him accepting the award, he's just like this funny little, like, hunched over looking guy. So.
Just a little nerd.
Yeah.
Well, I think there is a spin on the interpretation of this book that it's actually some sort of beautiful story about love and relationship.
Yeah.
Which I can see where you'd get that, but that certainly not was at the forefront of my mind.
Yeah, and one of the other things I read is, I guess, one of the reasons people really love this book is for the sparseness of the prose.
Ah.
And that he's almost evoking, to some people, Old Testament power in his writing.
Interesting.
Which I can see, although I didn't really get that.
I remember there was one point, like a quarter into the book, where there was like a really powerful turn of phrase. I don't remember what it was. I didn't mark the page number or anything. But there was something that he wrote, and the way that he wrote it just like totally caught me off guard. And I was like, wow, that was written really well. It totally doesn't fit with the rest of this book, but
I know we usually wait to talk about the writing until the end, but I did. I was going to comment on that because while he's, you know, trying really hard to set a tone, he does have some interesting phrases in the book, and even a couple that when I first looked at them, I had to reread it once or twice, like, what? Because he puts words in a place sometimes where you don't necessarily expect them to be, and I think he's showing, I don't know, like, he was trying to pare down his writing as much as possible, but then he couldn't quite get rid of everything. So it does make me interested to read one of his books where he's not going for that sort of style to see if all of his writing is interesting, vibrant turns of phrases.
I'd like to read another one of his books just to see if this is the only one that doesn't have quotation marks in it for speech.
Oh, I think that's
a stylistic thing of his.
I think that is a stylistic thing
of
his.
Yeah, that was actually on my to-get-to list.
Gosh, stop talking.
Yeah, I thought you didn't want to be on the air.
Yeah, surprise. Turns out I got a lot to say.
Okay, so I guess...
I didn't write the outline.
We will start with, Ben, do you want to give the plot synopsis?
I don't know if I'm ready yet.
I think it's an important thing, and you should give the synopsis.
Okay.
Okay. That was our plot synopsis. That was our little theater for you. Pretty much every exchange between the man and the boy in this book, to me, seemed to end with, okay, okay.
Yeah. They're always kind of vaguely upset with the world or each other, and they always just kind of, it always just ends with acceptance more than anything else,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, just like, it's fine, okay.
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 It's gonna be okay, okay.
As for a brief summary, basically, it's a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Something happened, we don't know what, that completely destroyed the environment, all of the plants are dead, seems like all of the animals have died off, and the world is covered in ash, which is constantly blowing across everything.
Yep.
And,
at some point in the recent past, there were blood cults, too.
Yeah.
They mentioned that right in the beginning. The blood cults are all gone now.
That's true. Yeah, during the, whatever the big event was that killed everything off, it sounds like the immediate aftermath of the breakdown of society was really violent and upsetting.
Yeah.
As opposed to the setting as it exists in the book, which is really violent and upsetting.
Well, I think the boy is born after everything happens.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's pregnant when it starts happening.
Right.
The mom, I guess.
Right.
Who's not in the book.
Right.
And the boy is, do we know how old he is?
Nope.
So he could be anywhere from 5 to 10?
Yeah.
I guess.
Somewhere in there would be my guess.
And so this is, you know, it'd be like if you had a zombie apocalypse 5 years after. It's people dealing with that.
Yeah.
All the zombies are gone, and you're just trying to survive. Oh, it's a little different than that, because there are no zombies in this book. That's probably a poor analogy.
Yeah, watch
it. I apologize.
It. Post-apocalyptic, if you mention zombies, people will assume there are zombies.
Yeah, there are no zombies. Unless, like, some of the scary people in the book count.
Right.
Post-apocalyptia is kind of like a trope in and of itself, though, now, you know? I kind of like that he doesn't go in too much to, like, why the world ended. It's kind of like if you read a time travel book now, you know, like, you don't have to explain the implications of time travel.
Right.
Because we've all read enough time travel books that we know, you know, don't step on any butterflies. You know?
Right.
Move on.
Just establish if you're in a paradox or a no paradox universe. Yeah. And then you go
and then
from
you,
there.
You move,
yeah.
You move
Everyone back. Gets how those work now.
Yeah. So with this book, we know that society is over.
And essentially, it's just the man is trying to get south to the coast with his son to warmer and maybe, hopefully, I don't know how hopeful he is, better living conditions.
Yeah, I don't know if they're actually looking for the good guys or if that's just what he keeps telling his son.
Right, to keep him going.
Though it sounds like there are a couple of very brief references to communes and people possibly being settled, like that the cities have some population groupings in them, though those are not very settled or civilized people. But if there are communes, to me that implies that there must be some kind of agriculture somewhere. It's probably not very easy, though.
I don't know. I was thinking, reading this, if they're only surviving off of canned goods, then everyone's going to die.
Well, there's kind of an expiration date on the human race, if that's the deal.
Yeah,
yeah. For sure. Because even canned goods don't last forever.
Right.
And
the ones they found have all been, are really old.
Yeah,
actually,
exactly.
At least 5 years, maybe more.
That's why I wonder if there's some kind of agriculture somewhere.
It's just everything they see is so dead.
Yeah.
Oh, they just find apples that are, like, edible, I guess.
Yeah, not very appealing, but edible. And so this post-apocalyptia all occurs in North America.
East Coast-ish.
Yeah, I think so.
Because they do find the ocean eventually.
Yeah, and they had to pass southward through some mountains.
Yeah.
And I don't know of any mountain ranges outside of the East Coast that don't run north to south. In the United States, at least. and so, that's, I don't know. I mean, I guess if you're a North American writer, that's probably where you'd set your post-apocalypse anyway.
Yeah.
Let America know they're not safe.
America needs to know.
I know, does he say North Carolina at one point in the book? I could have sworn that's where they went to find the ocean.
I think in a flashback, at least, maybe.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, okay. So, who are our characters?
Yeah, we have two whole characters.
Yeah.
We have the man and the boy.
Yep. They never have names.
That's true.
There's the man and the boy.
Only one person in the book has a name, and it turns out to not even be his name.
It's a fake name.
That's right.
Damn it. And we do have some other people kind of wander in and out, but never for very long, and they go away, and then it's really just about the man and the boy.
Right.
They're the ones who we really get in-depth on. And honestly, maybe we only get in-depth on the man. Since it's more focused around his doings and thoughts
right.
and memories and struggles than the boy's.
It's kind of his journey, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy is, like, it's a sacred object. He even says a couple times that he's been charged by God with this task of protecting the boy.
I think you learn a lot about the boy. I just don't think that there's a whole lot to know. You know, there's a lot of scenes where...
Because he's a boy.
Well, yeah. But there's a lot of scenes where the man is, like, trying to give him food without taking anything for himself, you know?
Right.
Oh, yeah, and the boy says, hey.
Yeah, and the boy's pretty much always, like, trying to be like, hey, you need to eat, too. Like, hey, you need to take care of yourself, too. And I think you learn a lot about him in that respect, but the man is the one with the history and, you know, the motivations and the stuff like that, and the boy is just kind of, like, grew up in this environment, you know? And
right.
So it's pretty much all he knows. So.
Well, the boy is also the weirdly morally centered for the environment he's growing up in.
Well, he is pretty well adjusted.
I was going to actually comment on that, how the boy, and I mean, maybe it speaks to how good the man has taken care of him, that he doesn't want to kill the dog and eat it, and he wants to help the people they run into.
Right.
And he gets really scared of things that little kids get scared of, And you would almost think if he was born after this apocalypse happened and grew up in it, that he would be, like, the one going, let's kill the dog and eat it, Dad.
Yeah, right?
Like, he would be the moral...
Whereas Dad's all about survival. And, I mean, he'll go to... He's willing to compromise himself morally to protect the boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also maybe a little bit not just to protect the boy once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely, when the thief steals their stuff and they track him down, that definitely felt more vengeful than protective.
Yeah.
You're
making the thief get all the stuff back, strip off all his clothes, and then just
right.
leave him on the side of the road.
Which is basically guaranteed death within a few hours.
Uh-huh.
And the boy was very upset by that.
Yes.
It's kind of hard to tell how long they've been in this environment, though, because it's pretty much like a common theme from the beginning, like that they only have 3 bullets in the gun.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And they only have 2 bullets in the gun.
Oh, really? Well, and at, you know, not too far into the book, they get into an altercation, and he winds up shooting a dude and blowing his brains
mm-hmm.
over his son, you know?
Right.
So he only has 2 bullets, but he's obviously not shy about pulling the trigger, so I mean, like, how long could they honestly have been?
Maybe he had a box of bullets at the beginning.
Maybe.
Well, because I thought that he had 3.
I thought it was 3.
For him, his wife, and his son.
Right.
And then they used 1 somehow when his wife was still around. And then they only had 2.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I don't want to be around anymore. I'll go wander off into the woods. And then I'll leave you guys with the 2 bullets so that if you ever come around to it, you can use both of them.
Yeah.
To get the job done.
Yeah.
Yep.
So... and I guess it wasn't 100% clear if the wife wandered off into the woods, I guess, after they had started traveling, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
To me, it sounded like she'd been traveling with them and just lost her will to live.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That wasn't when they were still at their house.
The one scene that I read with her in it, she seemed pretty hopeless, so.
Poor... I don't really blame her.
Yeah.
It sounds like a pretty
shitty I'm not sure if it's a world we'd want to be alive in, necessarily.
I'd join the blood cults.
Yeah. If the choice between blood cult or no blood cult, you always go blood cult.
You always go blood cult.
At the very least, you're not the one getting cut up.
Yeah. Or you get cut up last.
Yeah.
I guess, do you want to say anything else about the man or the boy?
No.
I mean, there's honestly, like, not a whole lot.
One's a protector, and the other is...
He's kind of like the one bright spot in humanity.
Yeah. I mean, he's set up to definitely be, like, someone who seems worth protecting. Like, he has a little bit of innocence, despite it being terrible, even though that is... impossible to be totally innocent in this environment, and like he knows some of the darker, deeper truths of life, and you know, he always asks, or he asks because he knows the answer, but are we starving, are we dying, are those people, you know, whoever used to live here, are they dead now? And then he also, there was the one scene where the man was trying to keep him from seeing the corpses in the road,
uh-huh.
and the son kind of said, there are corpses in this world, like, I've seen this dad.
Right, like, you can't really protect me from it anymore.
Right.
Yeah, so I guess the other characters who, we just more have character types, like in the cannibals... So there are groups of people who wander around basically hunting down people on their own or in smaller groups than them, and then either using them as slaves to do their labor or, like, sex objects,
right.
basically, because they see, like, a kind of... little group of people roll by with a wagon, and there are women trudging along or pregnant and stuff, and then you have the cannibals who take people and lock them all up in their basement and hack off their body parts one by one.
Saw off a limb at a time.
Yep.
Keep keep the meat fresh, so presumably.
The one guy who had both of his legs cut off and they'd been
cauterized
so he wouldn't bleed out. That was a pretty horrifying scene.
Yes. And I guess it kind of, there's a little bit of playing around with the idea of what would you do to survive. Would you even want to? Because, you know, the man, the boy, the wife, I don't know, we'll call her the woman, maybe.
Yeah.
Chose not to, ultimately, which, again, hard to blame her.
Yeah.
The man will do almost whatever it takes, and I think that he might even be willing to do slightly more, if not for the boy.
Yeah.
And the boy is this kind of last vestige of civilization somehow.
Uh-huh.
And I think he would definitely sooner die than have to kill somebody.
The boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Would you eat people?
I don't. I feel like in certain situations, I maybe probably shouldn't admit this, but whatever. In certain situations, I probably would. You know, like the plane crash in the Andes,
right,
or the soccer team or something. But in this world, because it sounds like so many of the people who survived are the people who are willing to compromise themselves and turn
what
we would consider evil, because that's the only way you can stay alive.
Right.
In that sort of situation, I would honestly probably be one of the dead people.
I've always thought that about, like, post-apocalyptic books and, like, disaster books and stuff like that. Like, there's all these stories of, like, people surviving. I've always thought, no, I'd probably be one of the 90%.
Yeah.
Was standing in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know?
I'm pretty sure. For all my big talk,
I just get, you know, I mean, you know, a rock falls on you, what are you gonna do? Like...
Right, yeah. If you somehow beat all of those odds, I think by the time you come out on the other end through luck more than anything else, at least for most of the survivors, there are probably a few rugged, individualist, cranky, deadly people who just don't have to worry, who, like, if they can survive nature, humanity doesn't have anything on them.
Yeah.
I don't think I could kill and eat someone.
Yeah.
Now, if someone's trying to kill me to eat me, and I killed them, I might go ahead and snack on them if I was hungry. Turn the tables.
I think if the world was ending, I probably wouldn't wind up too different than the people in the book, because they didn't compromise themselves by, like, eating people or doing anything.
Right.
But there are multiple times in the book where the man has to compromise himself by isolating himself from other people.
Right.
Like, the people on the road, and they're basically like, hey, we got some food, you know, come hang out and we'll all be all good.
Maybe the guy that he shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but, you know, he's got his, like, priority, which is his son there. And
we don't know who you can trust, because the people who survived probably are.
Yeah. So they haven't compromised themselves by, like, killing people or eating people or anything, but they've compromised themselves by isolating themselves, I think.
So. Mm-hmm. The book that I just finished reading on North Korea that I was talking about...
Yes.
Reminded me in some ways of this book, because it was a lot about the famine in the 1990s in North Korea and how people were starving to death and all the stuff that they were eating. And someone in that book, one of the interviews, said all of the good people died first. Mm. Because the government told them, your grain shipment will be here.
Right.
Don't go steal food. Or go buy, or, you know, whatever is against the rules. And they did, and they waited, and then they died because of it. And all the people who broke all the rules were the ones that survived.
Right.
And she quoted in that book someone who had survived Auschwitz, who said, when I left Auschwitz with all the other survivors, I don't think any of us ever wanted to see each other again, because we all would remember something we were ashamed of.
Right. I was actually going to reference that, the accounts of concentration camp survivors I've read and the things they had to do just to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't leave much space to be a good person sometimes.
Yeah. So, I don't know. There's something very... I think that's true to human nature, and that feels real.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you really can't be a good person in the way that we think of it without laws and, like, structure.
You can only be a good person with civilization, basically.
At least the way we think of being a good person, yes.
Right.
Well, you know, we're supposed to be social animals, you know, so we have civilization basically to kind of, like, keep each other in check, you know, so...
Right, but at the same time, there are social animals who totally have, I mean, like, pack behavior is based more on who is the strongest and will totally take the most for themselves, and if the weak one at the edge dies, no one really cares. That's true for primates, not just wolves.
That might even be true of us.
I would argue that there's undercurrents of that in our society.
Oh, well, and yes, if we want to get into a broader political discussion that has nothing to do with the road.
Yeah. True.
Let's move on. I mean, we already talked about some moral issues, but let's actually sketch them out. I, of course, will bring up my old standby of feminism and the fact that we do have the woman...
Right.
Who gives up and goes and kills herself.
Not a very feminist book in that respect.
Yeah, and all the other women who show up in the book are basically rape victims, is what it sounds like to me.
There's a couple in the cannibal tribe.
Yeah, there are a couple in the cannibal tribe, but...
The rest of them are pretty much, like, slaves or captives or victims.
Yeah.
Like, the majority of the women in the book are... not presented in a positive light, or, you know, not a very empowered light, you know?
But without the structure of society, how much of an empowered light is there to be viewed through?
Like, I think, you know, that there would be, I'm sure, some women out there who were with a person or two who could do what the man and the boy are doing.
Right.
Because the boy is a vulnerable person. And
right.
I guess if you consider a woman more vulnerable than a man just because she's more likely to be assaulted by a man.
I think a woman traveling on her own would absolutely be
vulnerable
in this circumstance.
So
be a bigger target.
Absolutely. So going with that, because I really don't like saying a woman's more vulnerable than a man.
Yeah.
But... if the woman's just as vulnerable as the boy, and the boy is making it okay with his dad,
right.
Like a woman traveling with her brother or her dad or whatever would probably be doing as well as...
It'd probably be more like the standry of people who clump together a little bit.
Yeah, and I mostly wanted to just meet a woman...
right.
That wasn't the wife and mother character who gave up on life.
Right.
And we really only get one at the very end, and even then...
She's also a wife and mother character.
And I thought she was kind of negative in her, like, oh, the grace of God has brought you to us. And then it was like, the boy thought she was dumb for saying that or whatever. And I was like, great, thanks, Cormac McCarthy. Like, you couldn't just give us the very end, like, a woman with a valuable opinion. Thank you for that. And, I mean, again, there aren't a lot of characters in general in the book, but I do think that you can't offer that up as 100% of the excuse.
Sure.
I think there could be a little bit of something, not a lot, you don't have to have, like, a badass woman tearing through the countryside with rifles, like, murdering people. And
right.
But something.
I think that definitely would have given the book a little more merit, you know, because it is kind of, like, bleak and depressing, you know, and it's very, you know, you can see why the woman, the original wife and mother went off and killed herself, you know, and there's pretty much, like, no hope for anything, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I think, you know, a female perspective thrown into the mix there would have been valuable somewhere, so.
Yeah, and it did annoy me a little bit that all of the man's memories of his wife, he talked about her breasts and nipples. I was like, really, guy, like...
I was surprised at the scene where he takes the picture of her out of his wallet
and leaves it behind
in the road and just walks away from it, you know? Even, you know, she is, you know, even though she's gone or whatever, you know, I'm surprised that he would just abandon the memory like that, you know?
I thought he was trying to abandon his past to survive in the present.
Well, sure.
That's kind of what...
Like a symbolic gesture that the boy is the only thing that matters now.
If he keeps remembering all the times with his wife
yeah.
in a world that was not shitty as shitty, then
yeah, and he does,
maybe he'll
he does
give
freak
up
out
too.
He does totally freak out the boy a couple times by being really, you know, when he like takes him to his house, they take like
mm-hmm.
a dangerous detour just to go see the house where he grew up,
right?
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And the boy's like, why are we even doing this? And it's sentimentality, you know.
Well, he also has this idea that thinking of anything good gets you killed immediately.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I
so,
liked.
Yeah. Which, I mean, you know, he has that mentality, but it's not necessarily true, you know, like the, just like abandoning the memory of his wife like that, you know, just like putting it in the road and like totally just walking away from it. That seems like almost kind of like one of those like vendetta things, you know, where like, he's freaking out the boy by thinking about his past. And so he takes it one step too far, you know? And then he leaves the picture of the wife behind. But it didn't necessarily have to be a thing that was weighing him down, you know?
I did think it was interesting that the man kept telling the boy, having nightmares is good, because once you start having dreams about good things, you've given up.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't remember that part.
Oh, that might happen later on, because the boy keeps having bad dreams, and the man says, basically, yeah, once you start having dreams about good things that don't exist, then you've given up.
Right.
Jeez.
And he himself has dreams about good things,
mm-hmm.
so maybe he's trying to...
But he doesn't trust, mm-hmm. but he doesn't trust them. He's taught himself how to wake up from those.
Right.
He's one of the things in there, too.
He doesn't really seem to trust much of anything.
Well, I don't think he's can.
Yeah, so...
Hmm.
I mean... Religious, spiritual...
Just, I mean, there's a little bit of a God thread in there, but it seems more of a... More of like a statement of, I have a purpose than an actual belief.
Well, I thought the conversation with the old man near the end of the book, and they run into him in the road, and they actually have a conversation about...
Mm-hmm.
angels and stuff.
Right.
Because of the boy.
Because of the boy.
Being an angel. And I guess maybe just more of a people on earth can be angels.
Maybe. He asked if he was
mm-hmm.
a god.
Mm-hmm.
And the man thought that would be a bad thing if he was.
Uh-huh. I mean, that conversation pretty much was the only direct reference. And honestly, I started going, like, why are complete strangers having this conversation? This doesn't make sense. Skimming past it, like, whatever. This book's so deep, but I don't give a shit. Take me to the action, man.
That's right.
Oh, there is none.
There
Oops.
Is none. Lots of ashes, though.
Lots of ashes.
Ashes to action.
themes, then.
All right, well, I guess, survival.
Yeah,
one.
I mean, I guess the main theme would be love and relationships and
right.
how that's what keeps mm-hmm. you going.
Because right.
that's really the only thing that's keeping these two people going.
Right,
because yeah.
they have no purpose for survival otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that theme, you can raise some of those interesting questions about what you would actually do to survive and if you would choose to live in that world or not.
Yeah. So kind of tying into the survival themes of just, you know, what is a moral or ethical action, you know, what is good and bad, those sorts of things are definitely in there.
They're questions that are raised, yeah.
Yeah. But I would say the main one, just because the man and the boy are really the only two characters,
yeah, yeah.
and their relationship is the focal point,
right.
that it really is just...
I would tend to agree. I mean, if you're going to pick a theme versus just what are some interesting issues that get examined a lot just as a result of the setting, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. is there a symbol in the book?
I don't know, is abandoning the picture of his wife a symbolic action?
I was thinking the ocean was a symbol of hope.
Yeah.
And possibly renewal, but...
As it turns out, not renewal.
Yeah, didn't really happen.
I
feel like the road should be a symbol of something.
It probably is.
Like, in this sort of book, I feel like there should be a lot of symbols in it.
Well, the road is...
Because it won a Pulitzer Prize.
It's dangerous to be on the road.
Uh-huh.
And it always... I mean, that's kind of a historical thing, too. Because if you go back not even that far in history, then those spaces between towns could be dangerous to travel mm-hmm. through, you know, highwaymen and such.
Right.
Right?
Animals.
Animals, I mean, depending animals. Where you are, yeah. especially, but, like, if you read a fantasy novel, then the road is always a dangerous place to be, or if you watch any story about, any historical story about traveling, you always have to be a little nervous about what a stranger might do.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, ancient travel stories,
mm-hmm.
because one of the reasons the Roman Empire was so venerated was because Roman citizens could walk on their roads and not get mugged and
right.
killed and all their stuff stolen. So maybe it's just a tie-in back to...
Well, like how close we are to that.
Because yeah.
those are, you know, in civilized times, that was an issue. Mm-hmm. In what we'd consider to be more civilized times, at least.
Yeah. Oh, man. I don't think we want to get into that can of worms. Okay, so I guess any more points that we want to bring up? We were having the conversation about the stand before. Recording.
Yeah. Just the whole thing of 99% of humanity seems to have died off, and there are people on foot traveling long distances, and you don't know what you're going to run into as strangers. And specifically when they were watching the little militia group go by with slaves and concubines and such, it was kind of reminded me of a scene in The Stand where they encounter, I don't know, a group of like three or four men who
uh-huh.
had a large group of women as prisoners.
They're keeping them all drugged up, so...
Right, basically, so they could rape them.
Yeah. Although some of those little ladies turned into big badasses after the fact. Stephen King included some women yeah. in his book.
And maybe for that matter, just a little bit of the one bullet for two people, the movie version of The Mist.
Oh, uh-huh.
As long as we're on a Stephen King thread.
And talking about bleak...
bleak endings, yes.
Yeah. Although, here's something I actually did want to bring up. So I was reading some reviews of The Road, because I was kind of trying to wrap my own mind around what my feelings on it were. Did I like it? Did I not really like it?
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to read some other people's opinions and see, like, well, why they didn't like it, to see if like, I agreed with them. And something really interesting that I saw when I was looking at this was there's a group of people who really like this book, but think that the ending is too hopeful.
Really?
Yes.
How did... Okay. So...
And I wanted to talk about that.
My question for them is, how do you make it less hopeful? Did they have the boy die too?
Well, I mean... The boy finds the new family to travel with.
Right.
And they have a mom and a dad and a little boy and a little girl.
Right.
So to some people, that's like, oh, he found a family that's going to take him in and take care of him.
Well, we don't know that.
Well,
that's my counter.
That's the implied ending.
Right.
That's going to happen. And I guess, for some reason, that's... I don't know. I don't really get how that's too hopeful. I'm like, well, the man dies, like, pretty gruesomely.
Right. And the new man that he meets right after that happens does a couple of small things that implies he might be trustworthy.
Yeah, he, like, offers to put his gun down and some other stuff to gain the boy's trust.
Says he'll wrap the man in the blanket. And
he does,
and he could have easily just have taken the blanket and...
Mm-hmm.
Gives him time to go say goodbye and actually waits for him. Like, those uh-huh. are all things I was wondering if they were actually going to happen at the time.
And the boy doesn't really have any choice but to trust these people, because if he says no, then he'd probably be dead real fast.
True enough, but so if the like the theme of the book is in a weird way family, maybe that's how it actually has to end.
Right, that he finds another family.
Right. Finds that limited security.
I mean, I kind of like it just because they talk about we're looking for the good guys, we carry the fire.
Right, right.
And then at the end, you hope that he did just find other good guys who also carry the fire, and that society's not just full of horrible, twisted people that kill everyone.
Right. And, you know, again, it is... I feel like I'm hung up on this point to some degree, but they do mention there are communes, which implies a stationary group of people living with some kind of law, and the man they meet, the thief, who they're pretty sure was kicked out of a commune because the fingers on one hand have been severed, like kind of implies he was a thief within the commune, too, and so there's some sort of justice system, even if it's more of a Code of Hammurabi justice system.
Yeah, and I would just wonder exactly how the communes work, because, I mean, the man was suspicious of them because they could easily turn into, oh, welcome new people, now we're gonna kill you.
Right.
And I wonder if they actually do that.
Right.
And if they do, then there maybe is a reason not to join a commune.
I guess the question is if you believe that whether nothing can actually be alive.
That's the thing that I think makes the ending of the book potentially not hopeful, is that I assumed everything was dead, and I said, yeah, these people took the boy in, that's nice, but in 5 years, they're all gonna be dead anyway, and the planet's just gonna be a desolate wasteland.
Right.
So, does it really matter? Oh, yeah!
Woo-hoo.
That's a cheery thought.
Yeah, I'm bringing the mood up, guys.
Yeah.
I just have to believe that if people are walking around, there are other creatures walking around. Like, anything smaller than us, basically, should still be alive in some numbers somewhere.
I was thinking insects are probably, should be, like, everywhere.
And
those things survive in...
And some plants. He said, oh, maybe they're giant squid at the bottom of the ocean, but everything near the surface is dead.
Uh-huh.
And let me tell you, anything that kills any detectable life in the ocean is going to kill all of us off without giving us the chance to wander up and down the road.
Yeah. Right. Well, I realize that tied into our question, so I
guess
I had to hold off.
It does tie into our question.
Mm-hmm. So, strengths and weaknesses of the writing. I mentioned, or Chern was mentioning, the turns of phrase and how people kind of consider the prose purposefully crafted to be kind of
minimalist.
Definitely minimalist.
Even with the punctuation, no quotation marks.
Uh-huh.
Actually, cut a lot of the apostrophes out too.
Yep. Yeah, and it's, stripped down to be more powerful and atmospheric as opposed to, you know, you can't really have lush descriptions when everything is covered.
Everything
in ash.
Is ashes.
And you're probably not going to have awesome conversations with people when you're struggling to survive.
Struggling to survive with a theory of isolationism.
Yeah.
I did think the book was... I did think he did a good job of creating the bleak atmosphere.
The atmosphere of the book, yeah, is very effective. I was reading this last week and it was raining. You know, 3 days in a row, and every time I'd look up from the book, I'd look out the window and be like, oh, God, it's the road!
I was actually going to say that the atmosphere and then the general feeling of paranoia when I left my apartment for work at 4:40 this morning, and the newspaper van was parked a few cars down in the parking lot. I was paranoid about another person being out. Just from reading the book, because usually I wouldn't think about it.
Yeah. I do wonder if it needed to be almost 300 pages long. Well, my copy is almost 300 pages long.
So is mine, but I didn't feel like it was long myself.
I kind of due. Just because not that much happened.
Right.
And a lot of it is survival, and there's not a ton of extra stuff, which isn't a bad thing, mm-hmm. but at some points I was just like,
maybe they could have walked a little less and cut out a couple of the scrounging episodes.
Yeah, and I was telling Ben, and I don't know if this affected my reading of it or not, but I saw the movie a couple years ago, or a year or two ago, whenever it came out, and I thought the movie was really interesting, really depressing. It's basically the book, except on screen. And I was waiting for episodes that had happened in the movie to happen while I was reading. And I wonder if I was just so anxious for the next plot point to happen because I knew what happened that I didn't relax and just read it as it came. And I wonder if I had read it without having seen the movie and not knowing what was going to happen, if I wouldn't have had that same feeling of this thing needs to hurry up.
Well, this is definitely one that I could keep a good pace up on because whatever the page count is, the minimalist text and the fairly significant amount of dialogue, like, you could keep up a more than a page per minute pace pretty easily. I mean, and that's less about writing and more about just readability, I guess. But it never, like, it went by fast enough that despite them not doing anything, I just, I don't know, like, I was actually felt kind of compelled to keep reading it. Now, I don't know that I would read it a second time.
I don't think I would. And honestly, I don't know if I feel like I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but whatever. Well, so many people really admire this book, and I think there's good reason. I personally, I didn't hate it or dislike it.
Right.
But it just wasn't really my thing. And I'm not really sure I'd recommend another person read it unless they were a certain kind of person.
Well, I think the main reason to recommend it would be if you're of a more literary bent. Because I think if you really think that way, you could pull a lot of stuff out of it if you wanted to. But I think if you're just wanting to sit down and read a book, and I mean, we like to think about what we're reading a little bit, but I don't want to sit here and analyze symbols while I'm trying to read a story.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to recommend, like, if I had to recommend just, like, one book to a person, I don't think it would be this one, you know?
Uh-huh.
Just because, I mean, it's pretty much just about a man and a boy surviving,
right.
You know?
That being said,
I mean,
I would read another book by Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah.
I'm interested to read another book by Cormac McCarthy because people who read him say this isn't necessarily a example of his typical work. And people who really like him online seemed to say Blood Meridian was their favorite. And so I'd be interested to see how he, you know, operates in a landscape where people are interacting and
right.
There's something more going on.
All right. So, have any questions?
Yeah. What happened that made everything die?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want the whole complicated backstory. I'm just kind of curious because it seems like everything burned, but it doesn't seem like they're swimming in radiation. So, I guess it wasn't nuclear, but there seems to be a nuclear winter going on.
Yeah, so you're trying, everything's covered in ash, and it's really cold and snowing all the time, which seems very...
So here's my theory. Doomsday device. It was one of those things where they're like, should we test this weapon we're developing? Well, yeah, let's go ahead, but let's blow it up out in the desert. There is a small chance that it will, however, ignite the atmosphere and burn everything, which is actually one thing they thought might happen with the atomic bomb, but they tested it anyway.
Oh my god. The scientists sister, I love them, but they're going to kill us. We made this thing that might accidentally create a black hole and, like, destroy the planet.
Like in Hyperion?
Right, which they do in Hyperion, but...
We figure out if it works or not.
Some people were afraid, like, the Large Hadron Collider was, like, going to kill us all. Right, yeah. Like, yeah. It's probably fine.
Probably okay.
It's like one of these days scientists are just going to be like, yeah, it'll be cool.
I always think of that Patton Oswalt bit where... Hey, we made cancer airborne and contagious. You're welcome. Science, all about coulda, not about shoulda.
Yeah. But we were wondering how, if there was nothing at all left alive besides people, how people were alive. Because there are, like I was saying, bugs are more resilient than people. You know, cockroaches could theoretically survive a nuclear apocalypse.
Ants are more organized than we are.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
As far as, like, a group of animals that lives together in harmony with itself.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Ants are number one. They're just too small to kill us yet.
So. Right.
And if you look at the past die-offs,
yeah.
At least according... The mass extinctions, at least according to the fossil record, like, you look at the... KT boundary, bye-bye dinosaurs, or the Cambrian-Permian boundary, which was actually way worse than that one, even.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nothing bigger than about my fist survives.
Yeah, and that's basically how mammals were allowed to evolve, because all the big animals died.
Right.
Because we were just little rats and mice and stuff.
So if there are no squirrels and no... plant life of any type around. I mean, I guess the idea is we can linger for a... That's just kind of what you're talking about earlier. Like, so we can linger for a few years on old canned goods.
Yeah, and apparently you can drink stream water and not die from it.
Right, which is, again, why I think they're not soaked in radiation. That and the guy seems to have, like, a coal miner's lung from the ashes.
Uh-huh.
And not radiation sickness or something like that.
Yeah, there's definitely more of a... TV, tuberculosis type thing.
Yeah.
Consumption.
So if anyone can think of a way that you could burn everything without radiation...
Don't tell any scientists.
Yeah. Don't tell any scientists, but do tell us.
Keep your damn mouth shut.
Because we're curious. our verdict.
I already gave mine.
Yeah, you did. I'm kind of in the... I don't know if enjoyed is the right word for reading it, but I read it, and I didn't mind reading it, and I think I'm landing kind of on pretty good again.
There's definitely stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
But...
Which, for the purpose of the podcast, is a good thing.
And this is, like, a really little thing, but the font they used for the title of the book and the page numbers... I hated it.
Oh.
I was like, that looks like such a stupid little cheerful comic-y
title. It's pretty jarring on the page, though.
Yeah. And it's like, here's this depressing story. Page 139!
It's too bad they didn't... It's too bad it's not one of those books where at the beginning they say this... Or end, I guess, is where I usually put it. This book was done with the following fonts developed by this person at this time. Because those...
Is that a thing now?
That is totally a thing. I've read a bunch of books with that. And they're, like, really proud of their font selection. Wow. I'm like, no one fucking cares. It's your font.
That's not true. There are
some
people
care about fonts.
There are people who care.
There are people who care a lot.
There are people who care a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't want to talk about fonts with them.
Okay. Me neither. I know that they're out there.
I just think it's a weird thing to be proud of. I'm like, can I read it or not? Like, if the font is so weird, my eyes cross, I'm out. Otherwise, I'm pretty okay with it.
Yeah.
I don't even get pissed off at Comic Sans, and that pisses everybody off.
Oh, yeah, Comic Sans does piss a lot of people off. It doesn't bother me too much.
It just looks like a teenage girl's party invitation.
You should definitely
who cares?
Not use it on a professional document.
That's why I do my resumes in Wingdings.
Oh, my God. Because we were working on a case, and the plaintiff's side was submitting all of their pleadings handwritten.
Hmm.
And they weren't even using notebook paper. Like, they drew the lines on and then handwrote the pleading. And I was like,
weird.
The judge should just throw your case out because you can't be bothered to go to a library and type that shit up.
Yeah.
Like, what is wrong with you?
You're done.
You were giving a business presentation right now. They would kick you out.
That's right.
But if they were writing a letter, that would be like a sign. Maybe they're just trying to go for like
the personal touch.
Yeah, the personal
human element of their testimony.
Real guy.
Yeah.
Dear judge and jury.
Dear judge.
Love me, XOXOXO. So what are you reading right now?
I started Into the Land of Bones by Frank L. Holt. It's about Alexander the Great's campaign in Afghanistan, which was not Afghanistan in Alexander's time. Called Bactra. And he's just looking at the campaign and how it went badly and how he murdered a fuck ton of people. And how kind of weirdly similar it is to more modern campaigns in Iraq. So he looks at the two British... Afghanistan, sorry.
Right.
The two British wars in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. the Russians, mm-hmm. and us.
And of course us, yes.
So, and he just updated the book in like 2010 or something, so.
Okay then.
Yeah.
I finished Dogs, so now the novel's done, I am leaping back into the demon-haunted world with enthusiasm. I only have like 100 pages to go.
You will finish it someday.
Hey, you know, most of my non-fiction reading, unless it's just completely riveting, I usually take a break and read a novel in the middle and then finish it off. So I'm just following my pattern.
I'm actually planning on starting Team of Rivals fairly soon, and that'll probably take me like an entire year to get through.
That's pretty hefty.
So, are you reading anything?
At the moment, no. The last book I read...
Kicked out.
He's reading the internet for us.
Yes.
That's true.
I'm reading The Internship. The last book I read was Sacre Bleu by Christopher Moore, which is about, it's like a alternate history sort of book. It's all about, like, Picasso and other painters that lived in that time, whose names I should remember, but and Christopher Moore, basically, he looks at the facts surrounding Picasso's death, and he's like, that wasn't a suicide. Like, a dude doesn't go out into the middle of a field to shoot himself in the face with a rifle, something. I don't remember the details. Basically, he writes this book, and it's like, Pablo Picasso didn't kill himself, he was murdered by, spirit of the muse.
I see.
And
by the Shrike.
Yeah. And the Color Man. And so, and it's about this muse who's running around and how these artists basically figure out the plot and change the nature of the art from evil to good. So.
Okay, then.
All right.
It's kind of funny. Christopher Moore, I don't know if you guys have read anything by him.
I've heard of him. I'm trying to think of what I've heard of him for.
He writes books, and they're supposed to be funny, but they're really dry, and so you can't even, like, always tell. But they are,
is he
like,
British?
I don't think so, but he does have, like, a weird, like, sort of, like, charm to the way that he writes, so.
All right. So, I guess it's time to start wrapping up here, and if you would like to comment on anything that you have heard so far today, or I guess anything that happens after this, that's probably much of it, you can leave a comment on the website, novelideaspodcast.com. Wow, I tripped over that and that came out sounding...
novelideaspodcast.com.
That came out sounding really weird. So that would be novelideaspodcast.com.
You can email us at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can tweet us at novelideaspod.
And you can find us on iTunes.
On the iTunes.
Just type in novel ideas, and we should be there.
And we'll rock your face off.
Yeah.
So next week, we will be reading Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie, because somehow we've never read it.
Whoa,
yeah.
Really?
We thought, that needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
So, we are reading Peter Pan.
Yes. And it'll be difficult, because I have no imagination.
Oh, I don't like it.
I'm guessing it's going to be like a 180 from the road.
Yeah,
pretty much.
They'll have very little in common.
Magic and whimsy.
Yes.
Are you You guys going to be able to handle the culture shock there?
I don't know.
Probably. Okay. I handle that pretty well in my literature.
Okay.
So that's going to do it for this week, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Sometimes science is fucking wrong and gives us shit we don't need, like 63-year-old women giving birth. Why not just come out and go, hey, we made cancer airborne and contagious. You're welcome. We're science. We're all about coulda, not shoulda.